Hello and welcome to episode 6 of The Northern Line. This month we're chatting with Ross and Jonathan about Viva Match and Matthew Tuck about pay. As always, we'll start with some useful dates for your diary. Pipeline is running on the 15th of October. This is a massively popular anaesthesia taster day and well worth attending if you're interested in a career in anaesthesia. Please let any junior doctors or medical students you work with know about this. It's free and gives an excellent insight and overview into the awesome specialty that is anaesthesia. On the 22nd of October, there's an essential pain management workshop for core trainees. This is a face-to-face workshop designed to improve understanding of pain pathology, acute, chronic, and complex. Check out the A-Line website to book your place. The next round of applications for the A-Line Educator Awards are now open. These awards are designed to recognise the regular contribution that so many of you make to A-Line courses and to go some way towards thanking you for this. Gold, silver and bronze awards are available. For each award, you will need to accumulate a certain number of points which are earned for participating in delivering courses or for creating new educational material. Using the self-assessment form, you'll be able to work out your cumulative score. Please check out the A-Line website for the application form. It's really easy to complete and provides you with valuable experience for teaching contribution, particularly for your ARCP. Anyone applying for specialty training should check out the Polish Your Portfolio Day on the 5th of November. It is open to Northern trainees and will give you excellent and invaluable guidance towards maximising your scoring in the portfolio station, including opportunities that are available within the region. Check out the A-Line website to book onto this day. On the 15th of November, the MEPA, or Managing Emergencies in Paediatric Anaesthesia, course will be running. This is a really useful course for those who are ST3+, and it covers a number of scenarios throughout the day with detailed feedback and an opportunity to run through these emergencies in a safe environment to improve your confidence. You can book your place through the A-Line website. The next post-fellowship teaching will be on Wednesday the 17th of November. This will be virtual as well as in person, but the location is yet to be confirmed. The programme includes trauma, burns, major incidents, extreme cold weather injuries, and major hemorrhage, so it will be well worth attending. Don't forget to book your leave. As you can hear, there's plenty going on, so do keep an eye out on the website and make sure to put future dates for study leave on your next change of form. They'll be coming around before you know it. Now we're going to hear from Ross and Jonathan about Viva Match, an incredibly useful resource for anyone who's sitting either the primary or the final Viva. Thank you very much for joining us on the Northern Line. Today we're going to talk a bit about Viva Match, so I'm joined by Ross and Jonathan. Would you both mind introducing yourselves and telling us a little bit about how you've got involved with Viva Match?
I'm Ross, I'm an ST6 anaesthetics in the Northern Deanery. I was approached by Chris Brownell, who's the head of A-Line, back in March to take on some sort of project. There's no secret, I've to get through the final exam. So I wanted to do something to help other people and hopefully succeed first time or at least increase the chances of exam success. And we had, Chris and I had a bit of a chat, and I went away, had a bit of think, and came up with the idea of a region-wide Viva system where we match up candidates based on their availability, and they can just Viva each other from home at a time that's convenient for them. And we would run that for a period of time leading up to the exam with a sort of introductory session, just to go over sort of the general gist of the structure of the exam, and also some things that I'd found helpful when I actually came to pass my exam in terms of hints and tips and sort of general change in mental attitude towards approaching the exam.
And hello everyone, my name's Jonathan. I am also an ST6 in the region, and I too was asked to be involved in this project, which was a fantastic idea that Ross came together with and has had a successful iteration for the most recent final sitting. People at A-Line were thinking, right, well, this has been successful, it's a really good idea, how can we expand it? How can we take this to the next level? And we realised that it's not just applicable to final sitting, this is easily translatable to the primary sitting as well. What Viva Match can do, or has the potential to do, is offer candidates a huge opportunity for lots and lots and lots of viber practice in the run-up to the exam. Now, we all know, I mean, you know, we've all done our exams here, and we know how difficult it can be. It can take many attempts, and you end up saying silly things, you know, getting all flustered, and there's no substitute for that experience. And what VibraMatch is going to do is give candidates loads and loads of opportunity to practice that, iron out all those little things. What's going to be key as well is that it's going to be online for the foreseeable future. And I've sat in on some people's exams, and I've seen it go good, and I've seen it go less good. And it's little things like the lighting, the way they're set up, their appearance, the environment that they're in. Already they're on the back foot with the examiners and they haven't even opened their mouth. So this is an opportunity to kind of test these systems out. And also, the big problem of Zoom, the internet connection, it can go at any moment, as we know. And this is the opportunity to be testing your systems, which area of your room of your house is going to be the best place to do it. Are you able to set up a hotspot easily in quick time? These are just some of the little things which will really make a difference. There are similar kind of things out there, I'll be honest. What I think what makes VibraMatch really unique is that we've come up with a system, we've got in some tech gurus and come up with some complicated algorithms and coding that will allow people to basically let us know, or let VibraMatch know, when they're available. Not, oh, you must be having this Viber practice at this time. We know that you can't commit to time so far in advance. We all do nights, weekends, we've got kids, we've got other commitments. So what VibraMatch does is it allows candidates to pre-select the times that they're available. And providing, you know, there's other people who have the same availability as you, you will be matched with them. And so it's at a time to suit you. It's from the comfort of your own home. And you can do as little or as much as you want. I mean, there are 3 sessions a day, every day for 6 weeks.
Wow.
If you want to do all of those, great, fine, for free. Actually, there is something in the coding that will not let you pick every single session, because that means you'll probably not be able to fulfill them all and maybe let some of the other candidates down. However, it's up to you how much you want to do. You know, if you want to do 2 sessions a day, that's absolutely fine. If you only want to do weekends, that's absolutely fine. And part of this coding system is to match you up with people with the same availability as you, send out the invites, set the time, set the place. A-Line will host the Zoom accounts. So we will just log on with Zoom Pro accounts, and we'll put trainees together, candidates who are sitting the exam together in the same room, as it were, and give them an opportunity to vibe each other. I don't know about the rest of you guys, when I was doing my exam, was quite difficult. You say at the start of a session with a consultant, oh, we'll do some vibe practice later. Doesn't turn out that way, does it? Yeah. Or you try and meet up with your friend and then you end up just chatting. we've all been there. So I think it just provides that kind of semi-professional environment for lots and lots of vibe practice. You get to meet other people in the region and beyond, who are doing the exam. When I did my exam, I knew one or two people in my hospital who were doing it, and we may have done a bit of practice, but you know, there's so many people out there who are doing this exam together, and you just don't know you're all in the same boat. And from the feedback from the final, this was key. They really felt that it was good to kind of at least make some contact with it, share some contact details, because you know, the VibraMatch will provide the environment for you to do it, but if you want to go off and arrange other things privately, well then exactly do that, but it creates that contact.
It sounds like it gives you a reasonable bit of accountability, not just to yourself, but to the other people who are sitting the exam. So it's very easy to decide at the end of the day, oh, we'll sack it off, we'll catch up tomorrow. But if you've made that kind of commitment, then you're more likely to attend, I would suspect, and more likely to put the work in, get it done, and then the rest of your evening or day, whatever time you've chosen, is your own.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's sort of one of the things that I tried to spell out to people at the start of the last sitting for the final, that, you know, they had to, if they committed to doing a session, then they had to treat each other professionally and turn up and treat it as a serious practice session. It's not an hour or 2 hours of chatting. It is an hour of Viber practice. We're not providing questions, and we expect people to put in the work and come up with either their own questions or take questions from their own books and vibe each other. Mm-hmm. But to at least have that attitude of, you know, I'm going to do this, I've set aside the time. If it's in the middle of the day and you've arranged to come up the list, then that's fine. But just be nice to each other and everyone is in the same boat.
I think the online practice must be invaluable, because I Mine were all in person when I sat the exams, and I'm not sure how I would get on now trying to do it online.
I agree. I mean, we've all done multiple fivers between us, some good and some bad. And I think we could probably all agree, or certainly I could, that what you know, your knowledge in passing an SOE is only half the battle. Somewhere near half, 50% of it is how you handle yourself on the day. The more you practice fivers, the better you will handle yourself on the day. In these COVID times, social distancing, busy lists, you know, rota problems, lots of rota gaps. The chance of doing this in hospital face-to-face with consultants and colleagues was low to start with, and it's getting less now. This is where I think this course will come into its own and just give as much practice as you want. And that's the key. It's as much as you want, really, in that environment, create that formal situation. In the first few times you do it, of course, you're going to lose track. You're going to start mumbling. You're going to start, oh gosh, am I really going down that path? And you will do that in the exam as well, but it's just how you kind of rein it in a little bit and how you control yourself. And I think the only way to do that is practice.
Absolutely. I find it's an excruciating process, but the more you do it, the easier it gets. And it's an expensive exam, so you may as well give yourself the absolute best chance. And the more you practice it, the easier it is. And I guess you make the better luck for yourself by practicing more.
Exactly. And this course is being run at cost. You know, the only fee is to manage the Zoom accounts, the pro accounts, really. The latest course is going at £25, which, if you think of a cost for a candidate, I'll pay 10 times that much to pass my exam. So I think it really should offer a really good value for money course as well.
Absolutely. And if people want to find out a bit more or sign up for the next round, what are your sort of time scales and how do they do this?
By the time this podcast goes to press, we'll be in the middle of the Viva match for the primary sitting in November. But the rough timeline of how these things work is that, you know, there's a registration period, which you can register via the A-Line website and book your course. Then there is a period where candidates are able to submit their availability. So we send them a calendar for the 6-week period, final 6 weeks up to the week where the exam starts. And the candidates can, for each day over that period, say, well, actually, you know, I've got my on-call rota here. Tuesday evening is going to be good for me, but not Wednesday. But actually, I'm on day off on Thursday. So sure, if I can do Thursday morning and so on. And you just kind of fill that in around the schedule that you already know. There is a week long period where those submissions are open and the candidates can go back and edit that if they want in that period. And then the submissions will close. A week later, Viva Match will send out a timetable with all your match sessions on, who you're matched with, and at what time you will be matched with. And then the week after that starts the Viva Match period, that 6-week period, and ends just before the sitting of the next exam.
So you have a little bit of time then to work out your rota.
Exactly. And this is what this course is all about. It's about working around you, your patterns, you know, what you're available for. We're not forcing anyone to meet at the time, but then we do say, but once you have a match time, it is important that you honour it. Absolutely. For your own practice, but also for the other candidates as well.
Have you had good success in getting people to be available at sort of equivalent times? I can appreciate with people being all spread out across the region and being on any number of different routers, this could potentially be challenging.
So for the first sitting that we did for the final in the summer, we had about 10 candidates who signed up, and we found that worked quite well. We were always able to match people up with at least one other person. With it being quite a small number, there were time periods where occasions where it was the same pairings being matched up, which with the next sitting we're going to work a bit harder to try and avoid that happening. But it's very much dependent on who signs up, how many people sign up, and people's availability. But we do our best to say, if you have signed up and said you're available, we will try to match you up, and we will try our best to vary as well who you're matched up with.
How many sessions would, say, over that 6 weeks period would people have matched up
for? So going forwards, we're looking to say that we would expect no more than 4 sessions a week. Mm-hmm. Or in a row, so no more than 4 days on the trot. And that's really just to sort of foster a bit of healthy work-life balance, and also to allow you to have a bit of time to actually study in between just having Viva practice, because it needs to be a bit of a balance. But ultimately, there's no point in us absolutely flogging you with Viva practice to the point where you're just completely burnt out at the end of 6 weeks. and you've fallen off, fallen over the peak and off, before you've actually sat your exam.
So further to that, the kind of computer programs that we're trying to bring forward for the next iteration is, say, to avoid people getting too many sessions in too many days in a row, and also not having too many sessions in a day. So there will actually be an option to say, right, my absolute maximum would be one a day, and you can choose that. But if you want to do two a day at the weekends, there's also the option to select that as well. So there's a few inbuilt mechanisms to try and make sure that people are not overloaded. We've run some kind of dummy candidates signing up for this session, and with what we think would be a reasonable submission of availability from an average candidate. And over the 6 week period, it's probably going to be about 20 to 25 hours worth of exam practice. On the face of it, might seem a bit daunting, but I think that is probably about the right amount of hours that you probably should be putting in a Viva practice. Don't forget, this isn't just 20 hours of full non-stop Viva practice. You will meet up with your fellow candidate. You will check what questions, or you kind of establish how you guys want to be doing this. The session really is your own. We're not going to enforce how you or monitor exactly how you run each other's Viva. But then, of course, there'll be the feedback afterwards. And this is key. It's not just about Viva practice. It's about giving each other feedback, critiquing each other. And I think this is a really good opportunity as well that perhaps you wouldn't get if you were just Vivaing with consultants or with senior trainees. It's really, really valuable experience to be on the other end. On the other side, seeing other people's mannerisms, their nonverbal communication. One, it will help them, but also you can take in so much into your own practice. So when it is you on the exam day, you know what looks good from the other side of the table. I think this is a really valuable experience as well.
You can sit and look at the texts and every textbook and every journal and et cetera, et cetera. But until you've practiced saying stuff out loud, I think that's the real test of whether you actually understand it. Because I know that I can read something over and over and over again and think, oh, I finally understand this now. And then someone asks me a question, think, yeah, no, I don't. I think you're right. You don't want to spend every waking hour vibing, but you need to put enough hours in so that you're not stressed out.
But also don't forget that, you know, the first few vibers you do, I mean, when we start practicing our vibers ourselves, the first few are absolute horror shows. The car crashes, you mumble, you can't put a few sentences together, and you end up having to, you know, it turns into a lot more of a conversation rather than a candidate telling an examiner what they know. But that will progress. This is what this course is about. It runs over 6 weeks. We're not expecting to be people be exam ready and have done all their revision prior to this. It's an evolving process.
For my own knowledge, because I'm not sure now how this works, I recall for the primary, particularly, there was an awful lot of sketching of molecules and graphs and equations. Are you still expected to produce such wonderful diagrams in an online Viva, or have we moved on from that?
So I sat the final online before Christmas last year, and I still sat and had a sheet of paper in front of me and used it to my advantage in terms of I was struggling away, and I drew some diagrams that were really for my benefit, but I was able to then talk the examiner through them from a distance and sort of re-angle my camera and say, well, you can look at this if you want and I'll explain it to you. I couldn't say for absolute certainty whether or not there is that expectation for people to produce at home a nice diagram of a circle system or the inside workings of a vaporizer. But I think if it wouldn't be unreasonable for them to ask you to draw something and to then show it to them on your webcam.
My understanding is that in years gone by, it was face to face. It was reasonable for the examiner to say, "Draw me the inside of a vaporizer." However, I think people have kind of moved away from that. You can certainly ask a candidate to explain, and if a candidate wants to use their own diagrams to help them explain, they can. And that is still a valid option in these environments with this online system. But as Ross says, this is another reason why you should be doing lots of practice, because you have to write it down so much bigger and clearer on your piece of paper when you're presenting it online than you ever would do face to face. And again, this is another chance to really practice this, get this nailed down, that you can do a quick graph if you want to, but with very big and obvious things, and you can hold it up at the right angle with the right lighting. And this should make the exam on the day then be a breeze.
So for people who are signing up, is there any cap on the numbers who can sign up?
The more the merrier, really. So the more people sign up, the more people we've got to match with. And hopefully, therefore, the broader range of people who will be matched with each other. So you'll have fewer sessions with the same person. You're more likely to have a greater range of availability. Everyone's welcome. If you want to do it, just sign up.
Is this open to people outside of our region?
Previously, when we did this, we tried to keep the numbers fairly limited to within the region, just because we were doing a kind of manual matching process. But since we've developed this coding system to allow matches, there is no upper limit. And we're confident that this course can build and build and really develop a reputation. And indeed, the next round will be open to candidates across the country, around the world, if we need to. And as I said, the more people that we match, the more likely you are that your availability will be matched. And the more chances of having a different examiner each time.
Thank you, Ross and Jonathan. The primary Viva match is now underway, but for those who are sitting the final, you can sign up for the next round, which kicks off from the 2nd of November. Moving on from exams, we're now going to hear from Matthew Tuck, who's going to talk us through understanding pay and what to do if it isn't right.
Hi, Matt. Thanks for joining me again. We're going to chat today about pay. We're going to chat about how it's calculated and how this can go wrong. So first, I thought we could talk about how you became a bit of a local expert in the field and a bit about your role within the BMA. So can you tell us about that, please?
Yeah, so I joined the BMA as a member as a student, but I didn't really become kind of active in any sense of rep position until I was an F2 in Hull. The strikes were happening, and you know, it was a pretty stressful time, but I'd got to know and worked with one of the kind of leaders of the committee at the time who was working in my A&E department. So I kind of got their undivided attention, and then they got to explain the issues to me. And I got very angry, as I think quite a lot of people did. And at the same time, I found that understanding more about how we got paid and how things worked helped me kind of focus that anger into, you know, explaining particularly to people and the members of the public about why I was angry. And it went from there. And so I kind of stayed involved with the committee through our regional Gene Doctors Committee in the Northeast here. And I think it's maybe been 6 years. It's been a little while now. So over that time, I've kind of seen problems with both pay scales, with, you know, England, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Wales, all the different versions. So that's been my experience. I've kind of been involved at various levels, and not so much as much of a position as I am as what used to be nationally. So I've kind of taken a step back from things, but that's helped me, I think, focus more on solving more local issues for people, which has been really rewarding.
Yeah, that's great. And I think you're right that as doctors, we maybe don't always take as much of an interest into the financial side as we maybe should do. So it's great to get a bit of education today. So thanks for that. So just starting quite basic then, the last Wednesday of the month, we get a pay packet, comes into our bank account. Where does this figure actually come from, and how does the LET decide how much to pay us every month?
So fortunately, there are documents that state how much you should be paid and where the calculation should at least begin. So the pay circular is something that the NHS employers in England publish, usually quarterly, actually, and it lays out our basic rates of pay, as well as all the kind of multipliers that add to that. So everybody, if we talk first, I guess the easiest most people would be relevant to would be the new pay scale. So that was introduced in 2016 and has been modified pretty much yearly since that came into being. You have a nodal point, which changes based on the grade of training you're at. And that may vary in size quite significantly between the start and the end of that scale. And this differs to how it used to be, where you would have an increment of a base pay each year you were just employed, regardless of your grade. So largely goes in line with your grade according to where you are in your curriculum, which is quite important for people who are sort of dual training. It becomes quite a sticking point there. We could talk about that maybe later. That base pay is then modified. So you have additional things, additional supplements for any hours you work between 9 p.m. and 7 a.m., which is a night shift. For those working in A&E, there are shifts that are categorized as night shifts, which is any shift that finishes after midnight before 4 a.m. a twilight or a kind of a disco style shift, as some places call it, that also attacks that 37% enhancement for each of those hours as if it was a night shift. You're also minimally contracted for only 40 hours. So we are all working, if you want to think about it, as more than full-time. So we think of 40 hours as less than full-time. Actually, 40 hours is your contracted full-time hours. But everybody, for the most part, has an additional, on average, 6 hours. Interestingly, you don't get any additional annual leave. So all your annual leave is actually based on working a 40-hour week. So if you work 6 hours above your 40, so you work on average 46 hours, you get your total basic pay divided by 40, and you get 6 more chunks of that added to your pay. Then there's weekend allowance. So weekend allowance is based on the frequency of weekends you work across a rota cycle. And that is 1 in 2, 1 in 3, 1 in 4, and they're subdivided into brackets. And each of those gives you a percentage on your total pay, and it lifts everything up. That has implications with less than full-time, which I think we can talk about implications of a bit later. So broadly, if you take your basic pay, which is based on your grade of training and your curriculum, your additional hours above 40 that you work, your enhancements for the night times that are listed in your work schedule, as well as the weekend frequency, should come out in what is your annual salary before tax. For some people, that might vary. So they might be in a specialty that attracts a pay premium, which was used to try and incentivize training in certain areas. Some people in GP might receive that, or A&E psychiatry. And some people, if they had transitional arrangements between the two contracts, may have the number slightly varied. But that's roughly what makes up your pay in the 2016 pay scale, which the majority of people are on. The older one is much more simple to talk about. So it's probably going to take about a third of the time. So you had a basic pay that was based on years of service and your grade, and would increment each year, even if you were out on, for example, maternity leave or research within an university setting. And onto that would be applied a really rough percentage, which was called banding, which would be, used to be three categories that everyone knew, 1, 2, and 3. And in that you'd have A, B, C. When this was first started, this was when junior doctors were working 100 plus hour weeks routinely. And it was used as a really kind of blunt tool to try and reduce those hours and force measures on employers. Over time, most people ended up working 1A, 1B rotas. And you could work vastly different shifts to your colleagues and be paid the same. So it wasn't really designed for that way of working. Hence the kind of reform of it back in 2015 as it started. So that's based on how many of your hours you work in a week are outside of plain time. So there's a calculator you can do and work that out. So this is relevant for people who were ST3 or above at the time the contracts changed and haven't had any time out from employment. So if that's you, that stuff's all available on the internet through your trusted sources, whether that be independent groups or your trade union to look at. So that is how your pay packet is at the end of it. That's your gross number. There's a lot of things that are then taken from you, but that's how you work out your kind of gross figure.
Great. Thank you very much. I think that's a good overview of all the different ways that we can sort of earn money and how the pay is divided up between different shifts. But of course, we don't submit sort of, you know, our working hours to the Let every month, do we? And they have to go off something else, which is our work schedule. So do you want to tell us a little bit about how the work schedule is calculated and its importance in our monthly pay?
Yeah, absolutely. So the work schedule is a document that starts being generic to you. So when you first get it, it is a work schedule for your grade of training in that setting, that department or practice. And it lays out a number of things. So it should tell you who your supervisor is, your department, the educational opportunities available in that block, and also crucially pay. So it should give you a generic schedule and sort of roster of how the work, your working pattern will look. So it may not say on like Monday the 25th, you'll be doing a long day, but it will say, they will call it sort of weeks 1, 2, 3, 4. So, and so on. Usually most rotas are sort of an 8-10 week pattern, some are 6. And it will say, and you'll be able to clearly see, hopefully, how many of those total days across the rota are normal days, however your department defines that, long days, nights, weekends, and it should all be kind of coded in there so that it should give you enough information to be able to go away and do your own kind of ready reckoner and check of sort of back of the napkin kind of calculations about whether what is on there is correct. And it will also make the adjustments and list them if, for example, you are less than full-time or if you have other arrangements for pay because you moved between the two contracts since 2016. That worksheet is really important. So that is drawn up by the hospital or practice or community setting where you work. They submit that to the let. So the let assume that that is accurate and that your rota that you actually work on a day-to-day basis mirrors that work schedule. They then send that work schedule to their HR and payroll department, who run it through a program that spits out the number that you should be paid, which for the most part will be accurate. Although it's always worth checking because there's always, ghosts in the machine with these things occasionally. So what's really crucial here is that the rota that you work on a day-to-day basis needs to match the work schedule that you were sent by your department, because that is how you are paid. That's how the let figures out how much to pay you. They don't know what your actual rota is on your e-roster or your Excel spreadsheet. They have no idea what that says. So that's crucial that all matches up, and any kind of break in that chain or error along that way will affect your take-home pay at the end of the month.
Yeah, I think that's really important to emphasize the work schedule in all of this. I'm sure a lot of people have a wee look at the work schedule when it's sent out, but maybe not much more than that. But of course, after listening to this podcast, everyone's going to want to inspect the work schedule against the hours that they've worked. So if you've got any advice for, those of us who want to have a closer look at our work schedule now and make sure that it is right.
My advice would be to either to open it at a time when you can actually look at it properly. So it's probably not, at the start, just after a case is started on your phone on a small screen as a PDF. Take some time, set aside some time, maybe half an hour, to open it up on a proper screen or print it out on paper if that's what you prefer, and just and compare them. And what you're looking for is that pattern. You're looking for, okay, when does this rota, when does sort of the pattern of nights reset? And that's your cycle of the rota. And within that time period, so that might be from that first week in August to the end of September. That might be the end of that cycle, and it all then repeats, the pattern of shifts repeats. And you want to compare the numbers that are in the worksheet. Because the worksheet should say how many weekends in figures, like, you will work 4 weekends, you will work 7 long days or however many. And that you need to compare that across. Some places you enter the rota cycle at different points. So you might be unlucky and enter that rota cycle on long days and leave it when you leave that department also on long days. So your experience may differ to a colleague. So we still don't yet have truly individualized pay, but it is an average of the experience one might work if you were doing that role. It is more specific to you than the old pay calculations were, but it isn't yet completely specific to you. So there is a bit of wiggle room here. But ultimately, it's that pattern, the move between nights and long days and regular days and the days off in between. And I think quite a lot of the errors come with rest after nights. So sometimes people don't get their full allocation. So you get 46 hours after your end of a night shift, of any night shift. So just even if you do one, 46 hours, clear rest away from work after that shift. And that should be reflected in your work schedule and your rota. So there's things to do with pay, and there's also things to do with what has been deemed safe working, which is also a part of what a work schedule is meant to ensure that you get.
That's great. Yeah, thanks. So just before we leave the work schedule, then hopefully it won't be the case. But if we do, if we have some suspicion that our work schedule doesn't match up with the contract, or that it isn't, obliging with the contract in any way, is there anything we can do about this, or any easy ways to check that it does match the contract?
So if you think what you're working differs from your work schedule, then that triggers the utility of the exception reporting tools. Now, I know for some people that isn't what they were used to. It wasn't the way of working that they started their career with. So it's more clunky, it's more difficult. And sometimes you might personally prefer to come to an arrangement with your department separately, which is your right. And it's a tool that you can utilize. Exception reports have a really visible trail. So they are directly reported to the Guardian of Safe Working, which is a role that exists within England as part of the new contract that came in 2016. They are reviewed by the Guardian of Safe Working annual supervisor, and also the number of exception reports and where they're coming from gets reported to the board. So the CEO of that hospital or site or practice or the practice manager will see them. So in effect, there is an audit trail. So it's an effective tool sometimes for your consultants or your allies who are pushing for things like expanded funding for filling that rota, or maybe, for example, increasing locum rates to fill gaps. So exception reports have their utility, not just getting you paid for the hours you've worked that haven't been included in that work schedule, or getting you time back, whichever be your preference, but also improving things for your colleagues who will come after you. Separate to that, there's kind of two parts to this. This is, if you've worked more than you should have, there's sorting out getting paid or time back for what you've done, which, you know, if you would prefer to ask a department for locum rates, you absolutely should. And then there's moving forward, what do you do about the change? So actually, you need to make it very clear to your department, whoever managed the rota, actually, you're working beyond what you're being paid for. This isn't acceptable, and they need to change it. So what they can either do is they can change the rota to match the work schedule and say, you're right, we're working too much, we're not paying for these hours, so we'll change what you're working so that it all matches up. Or they can say, well, actually, we really do need you in at this time in the morning, and so therefore we're going to pay for it. And so they can submit for the work schedule to change. That will go to the LET. The LET will then modify your pay, which, if you're working more hours or they're more unsociable hours, then that will increase your rate of pay at the end of the month. So there's a number of things here. There's kind of things to fix what's happened, and there's things to remedy it from happening in the future, both of which involve talking to your rota coordinator and maybe at some point the lead employer.
Great. Yeah, so I think we have definitely hammered home the importance of the work schedule, and that if your work doesn't match the work schedule, then your pay will be wrong. Is there any other ways that your pay at the end of the month could be incorrect? And I'm thinking sort of tax codes or anything else that can go wrong, that means that what you get paid isn't what you should be paid.
So many people remember before lead employer arrangements existed that we, you know, if you changed hospitals after 6 months, you would effectively move employment. So you would move from, you know, Tuesday to Wednesday to a different hospital, but HR and payroll lags behind that. So the systems that produce things like P45s at the end of employment that tell your next employer how much tax you've paid and what your income is and what you should then be taxed for going forward are antiquated. So they take weeks. So HMRC really advised that you should never call them about a tax problem when you go somewhere new for at least 6 weeks, because they know they won't have got all the information through yet. So lead employer arrangements reduce the risk of tax code errors dramatically. So most people would find when they move from an employer to a new one, or maybe they move from being a core trainee taking time out in between and then moving into higher training, something that's particularly pertinent right now for anaesthetists, that as they move from lead employer to host trust back to lead employer, that they will have at least that first month paid on kind of emergency tax or basic rate tax. And effectively what's happening is that HMRC are basically giving themselves the benefit of the doubt rather than you. So they are kind of just assuming that you don't have a personal allowance, that this might be your second income effectively. So are taking more tax than they should. So that could reduce things. They don't really work that fast to correct this. And if you say to HMRC, I think I paid you too much, what they tend to do, rather than giving you that money back there and then, they will adjust your personal allowance for the rest of the year. So a personal allowance is how much the government allow you to earn before you pay tax on your income. And that varies from budget to budget. So you can earn up to that point, and then above that you pay basic rate on everything, and then the next threshold you pay percentage on everything above that, and so forth until you hit top rate of tax. Ultimately, if your new employer doesn't have your P45 or P60, then they're going to put you on some form of more extreme taxation arrangement. Unfortunately, there is very little you can do, because your current previous employer cannot issue a P45 until you have ceased working for them. And clearly we do not have gaps in employment the way that maybe other people do. We go from working day one somewhere to working day two the next. So unfortunately, that is very hard to smooth over. And really the only thing that's made any steps to improving that is having the lead employer arrangements that we do. So unfortunately, that's kind of things that maybe if you know you're going to switch from employer or through moving to a different region, that's something to factor in if you can in your kind of financial planning for the year. And that is really the only kind of cast iron thing you can do for that.
And does it usually involve a phone call to HMRC then to correct, or should they sort it out themselves if you give them?
I would always eventually call HMRC and make sure they've got things and clarify, because you know, this is important. This can for some people can be thousands. Also crucially on this matter, when you do this, you really should tell HMRC about everything else that you can have tax relief for. So if you have to pay for things that are solely for your employment, you get tax relief on that. So you don't pay tax on the income that you used to pay for it. So for example, postgraduate exams are classed as required for your continued employment. So you can have tax relief on that. So effectively you get about 30 something odd percent back if you average out your kind of tax payments if you across the bands, roughly sort of just over 30% on everything you pay, for example, college fees, exam fees, medical indemnity, and things like trade union fees, professional association fees, all that is taxed, and GMC registration fees, all that you can have tax relief on. So when you're sorting all this out, as well as fixing the tax code, also speak to this person about adding that, and they will just keep that on record and carry it over each year. So for a lot of people, this is a huge amount of money.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I did that myself not so long ago. I just did it online, just Googled it, sorted it out in no time, and I got a check for a few £100 in the post. So definitely worth doing. And like you said, you can backtrack it for a few years. So if you haven't done it, then that's definitely something to look into and do.
I mean, a lot of groups as well that you might be a member of make a pre-template letter and table, and they will put, and things like the GMC, you can ask them how much you paid them over the last 3 years, and they will tell you. So you can get all these societies and memberships and associations to itemize your payments to them, so you can go back 3 years and request these records, and they know about this, so they make that available to you. So worthwhile doing. It's the easiest money you'll ever make. It's more money than you'll ever make for any particular locum rate you've ever negotiated.
That's right.
It's your money. It's your money.
Exactly. Yeah, no, you're quite right. So so just coming back to sort of pay at the end of the month, I just wanted to touch on, and we sort of briefly mentioned it before, less than full-time trainees and how their pay schedule and, you know, pay at the end of the month is different. And, you know, I would imagine quite often it's a bit more complicated and there's more room for errors and probably more common to have errors in these trainees. So have you got any advice for them or anything in particular for those guys to look out for?
I do. And I have a particular gripe about this. I have been less than full-time in the past. So I have an acute awareness of the problems that come from this, as I'm sure many anaesthetists in training in this region do as well. And the crucial thing about this is that you need to be compared to the full-time equivalent version of you. So there will always be a work schedule with the full-time equivalent of what you would be doing if you were there full-time. So even if you are the only ST6-7 in that department, and you're less than full time, there will be somewhere a full time work schedule for your role. And that's really key, because you are paid a proportion of the full timer's total amount. So let's talk about the weekend allowance, the weekend frequency, because that's a really good example to use. For example, if a full timer on the rota worked, for example, a 1 in 2, so it's pretty extreme and not really allowed in most departments now for various rules, you'd receive the highest weekend uplift. Now, if you worked less than full-time 50% on that rota, your actual total weekends you would work physically, if you're looking at the, you know, a calendar, would be 1 in 4, because you work half as many weekends. But actually, you're working half of a 1 in 2 rota. So you don't get the reduced rate for 1 in 4, you get your pro rata amount of that 1 in 2 allowance. So you're basically, how much of a full-timer's job are you doing? And it is pro rata of everything. So a lot of places have, over the years, maybe miscalculated things like weekend allowance for less than full-time trainees, particularly if you're working somewhere that has maybe like a 1 in 6 and you're doing 60% of that, you might not get any weekend allowance because they've erroneously thought, well, you're only working like 1 in 10 weekends. That doesn't bring you an allowance. But actually, you're working a proportion of a 1 in 6. So you should get a proportion of the 1 in 6 uplift. I think that is where most of less than full-time pay areas come from in the new pay scale, is probably that weekend frequency, because nighttime hours are easy to see. The other issue for less than full-time workers is the actual rota worked. So if you are 60% less than full-time and you want your pay to be accurate, then you need to be, the work schedule that you have needs to match your worked rota, just like before. But you need to be more mindful of the fact that you shouldn't be doing, you know, a 60% of, you know, of the daytime lists, but still doing maybe 80 or 90, 100% of the nighttime stuff. It should be pro rata of everything. As I say, you are a proportion of a full-timer. You are not, you know, pick and choose, cherry pick from the employer parts of a full-timer. And you should have a pro rata amount of it all. So the training time, the kind of the more service focused element. And crucially, you know, for me as a full-timer, I need my rota and my work schedule to work out, and my pay slip to work out if my pay is correct. As a less than full-time trainee, you need your pay slip, you need your rota, you need your work schedule, but you also need the full-time equivalent of your work schedule to make sure that you are doing 60% of a full-timer or 80% of a full-timer and not some weird hybrid. Because again, if that's wrong, your pay is going to be wrong either in your favor or against you. So there are particular issues there. And also, some people have been around a long time and departments forget what grade you should be and all this sort of stuff. So there's basics there in terms of explaining to people what you are, where you've been, and what you should be paid. And all the rest is really, it seems complicated, but actually it is almost as basic as if you're 60%, you are 60% of the full-timer, and it's as clear as that. And there really shouldn't be any arguments against you for that. Yeah. And so for those people who are struggling with kind of all the words I'm saying, the stream of audio, there are numerous groups and online resources that actually lay this out in a more kind of diagrammatic form of what I'm saying. So whether that be the BMA, whether it be sort of like Money for Medics or Finance for Junior Doctors, all those kind of websites. I've had a look at most of the more common ones, and I'm happy with the content of most of them. So I don't think you can go wrong with whichever resource you use. But if you're struggling with kind of it just explained as an audio, there's a lot of pictures and diagrams of this that are quite helpful if you're struggling.
That's great. And we'll see if we can hopefully add a link to one or two of these in the sort of description of the podcast below. That would be useful if we can get that. So that's great. So just sort of as we do start to wrap up, is there any other sort of words of wisdom or advice for trainees, or finally any contacts that people can reach out to if they do think that something's wrong, or if they just want a bit more information about what you've mentioned?
Yeah, I think in terms of pay, a lot of people struggle, I think, with the idea that working out what they're meant to be paid and approaching pay as a topic with their seniors. You know, quite often you don't really want to bring money into that sort of educational mentor relationship you have with consultants. And it's one of the strange things about the NHS is that sometimes our kind of close clinical colleagues are so responsible sometimes for what our salary is. And really just, you know, take it to HR, take it to the people who can actually change it. Take, you know, clear evidence and, you know, screen grabs or references to kind of the pay scale and the contract, and things do usually work out for the best. If you're not getting a response that you find satisfactory, there is always a way of escalating it. So there's various mechanisms for depending on kind of where you want to take it. Speaking to the Guardian of Safe Working, speaking to you, the head of your department, your education supervisor, if they're kind of minded on this sort of stuff. If not, it's maybe seek advice from a kind of trusted colleague. Clearly there's options in terms of union representation. I'm a member of the BMA. I found the pay stuff really helpful on the website. Most of it isn't behind a kind of a member login. You can get a lot of it without, although clearly if you want sort of bespoke support, membership of an organization is usually required. And don't give up, because you earned this money. You've gone into work and not done something fun or not spent time with your family to earn this money. And if someone is withholding it from you, that is, you know, unconscionable in my mind. So there's ways of getting it for you, whether that be from the employer or from the tax man. And, you know, it's all worth it. And crucially, not just for you, but also to kind of realign those boundaries, to, you know, maybe stop the overreach next time for your successes. And yeah, there's a lot of, you know, most people have been through almost all of this. There's never a unique case. So a lot of us have seen most of it before. And, you know, I'm always happy personally as well to be contacted. And I know a lot of people in the kind of less than full-time world who've been around a long time also have a huge extensive range of skills and knowledge on pay. I won't share their names in case they don't want to be contacted, but I'm sure people will know who I'm talking about.
Definitely, yeah. There's plenty of contacts within the Northeast, and like you say, I'm sure everybody would be more than happy to be contacted if people have sort of specific questions. So I think we'll leave it there then. Thank you very much for your time today, Matt. You're clearly very knowledgeable in the topic, and I think that will be very useful for a lot of trainees. Hopefully that's answered some of people's questions.
No problem, Johnny. I mean, it's just to say as well, like if there's anything that we haven't covered, I mean, tell Johnny, I don't know, tell somebody, and we can always, if it's clearly something that keeps coming up, we can address it, or just email me or whatever you need. But basically, if there's something you don't understand or you're confused about, don't suffer in silence. We can always find a way to help you.
Yeah, no, you're right. You can send feedback to the Northern Line podcast email address, which will be down below as well. And we can always do another recording to answer some of those points. That's great. Thanks very much, Matt.
No problem.
Thank you, Matt. Understanding how your pay is calculated is so important, yet it's something which can seem incomprehensible at times. There are links in the podcast description which may be helpful if anyone has questions or needs more information. Thank you for listening to this month's Northern Line. We'll be back next month. Take care.